From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at the BBC in London this week. It is Here and Now, and we start the hour in Washington, where by a vote of 232 to 196, the House of Representatives voted this morning to proceed with their impeachment inquiry, setting ground rules for what is now only the fourth time in American history that lawmakers have gotten this far along in the process of trying to remove a president from office. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke on the House floor before the vote.
This is a solemn occasion. Nobody, I doubt anybody in this place or anybody that you know, comes to Congress to take the oath of office, comes to Congress to impeach the President of the United States, unless his actions are jeopardizing our honoring our oath of office.
Elsewhere on Capitol Hill today, testimony continued behind closed doors from the first Trump political appointee to answer lawmakers' questions in the impeachment inquiry. Joining us now is NPR's Tim Mak, who covers national security and politics. And Tim, was this basically a party line vote today in the House?
It was a roughly party line vote, but two Democrats broke with their party to oppose moving the impeachment inquiry process forward. One was a Democrat named Congressman Jeff Van Drew. He is a freshman in a vulnerable district in New Jersey. After the vote, he explained why he opposed moving forward. He said that there wasn't bipartisan support for that inquiry. He believes that the inquiry will divide the country and will ultimately fail in the Senate. But he says that now that the inquiry is moving forward anyways, that he will be making a judgment call based on the evidence presented by the investigations as they go forward. So Van Drew and Democratic Congressman Colin Peterson were the only two Democrats who opposed the measure. And Republicans are now pointing out that it was a bipartisan vote, but it was a bipartisan vote to oppose moving forward with impeachment.
What changes now with the inquiry now that they've taken this vote?
So the inquiry moves into a new phase. You know, up until now, the interviews have been behind closed doors. That's something that Democrats say has been necessary to prevent witnesses from coordinating their testimony. Republicans have criticized this process, and they've said that the process hasn't been authorized by the full House. They're also saying that interviews should be done in public. Now, with these new rules, they will eventually get both. Interviews will soon be moved into a public setting, first hearings in the House Intelligence Committee and then hearings in the House Judiciary Committee. But Republicans are still calling this a quote-unquote Soviet-style impeachment process.
And in fact, today, Texas Republican Congressman Brian Babin said the president did nothing wrong in a phone call with the Ukrainian president in which Trump pressed for an investigation of Joe Biden and his son Hunter in Ukraine. Listen.
My view, our president was doing his job, ensuring that if taxpayer dollars from my constituents and yours was going to the other side of the world, that it would be paired with a commitment to crack down on corruption at all levels, no matter who someone's daddy is or what their political ambitions are.
So some defense of the president on the House floor. What are you hearing from the White House today about the proceedings?
Well, the White House is calling the process a quote-unquote sham impeachment process. They say that the president has done nothing wrong, and they're accusing Democrats of a quote-unquote unhinged obsession with this impeachment proceeding and argues that it hurts the American people to go down this path.
Meanwhile, Tim, we said that Tim Morrison, who's the first political appointee to testify in the impeachment inquiry, is being asked today about what he knows about that July phone call with the Ukrainian president and President Trump. He resigned last night from his position as a top official on the National Security Council. He is a former longtime Republican staffer at the House Armed Services Committee. Is it going to be hard for Republicans to undercut his testimony?
You know, this is the thing, not just with Tim Morrison, but so many of the individuals who have testified before the House Intelligence Committee. They either have a background in Republican circles or are official national security officials and diplomats who have worked under administrations of both parties. I mean, the president has tried to undercut testimony by accusing those who testify against him as quote-unquote never-Trumpers or folks that have always secretly opposed him. It remains to be seen whether this will be effective. And I think a lot of the public assessment of these witnesses will largely depend on how credible they seem in the coming public testimony when we move into that new phase that has been authorized today.
And do we know if the former National Security Advisor John Bolton will actually testify next week?
Well, he's certainly been asked to by the House Intelligence, Foreign Affairs, and Oversights Committees. Lawmakers running this impeachment inquiry have asked him to appear to provide testimony next Thursday. The deposition notice notes that it requests a voluntary appearance. Now, Bolton is expected to testify only if a subpoena compelling his testimony is upheld by the courts, according to a source familiar with his legal strategy. So he is kind of unwilling to go along with the impeachment inquiry unless he's compelled to by a legal process.
Tim, just briefly, given how long this is taking so far and the fact that tomorrow's November 1st, they wouldn't be able to go through the whole impeachment trial if it gets that far by the end of the year, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, Republicans argue that if the president is given due process and if Republicans have an ability to issue subpoenas, that it will take weeks and weeks to properly go through that process. There hasn't been a set schedule, although, as I'm sure you know, Democrats have hoped to finish the House side of these proceedings by the end of the year.
Tim Mak at NPR, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, to California now and the wildfires. We've been reminded how fast they move, propelled by winds of 70, 80, even 90 miles an hour. In Northern California, those winds have subsided somewhat, and the Kincade Fire in Sonoma County is now 60% contained, but still 180,000 people have been forced to evacuate there. In Southern California, the Easy Fire that exploded on the hills near the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley early Wednesday have chewed through 1,600 acres of land. The library, by the way, narrowly escaped the fire, saved by a shift in those winds. And in San Bernardino, firefighters are battling a new fire, the Hillside Fire, which broke out Thursday morning. Today has so far burned 200 acres of land. KPCC reporter Sharon McNary is in Pasadena. Sharon, this is one of the places under a red flag warning, so remind us what that means and what you're seeing there.
Yeah, a red flag warning in Southern California means that you have high winds, low humidity, it's very dry, and generally hot temperatures, although this week we are experiencing cool temperatures. It's the heat, it's the wind and the dryness that can create conditions that are very favorable for dry brush to catch fire and spread very quickly, endangering homes and businesses and people.
Well, now position yourself, Pasadena, because we know evacuations have been lifted. The orders have been lifted in Martinez, Crockett, Santa Rosa. But what are some of the areas that are still under extreme fire danger, and where are you in the middle of this?
Well, I've been for the last 3 days out at the Getty Fire, which is near the very famous Getty Museum.
In the south.
It's a part of, it's outside Los Angeles. And it's part of West LA, a part of West LA that has not burned in a long, long time. So there was a very heightened concern over whether that fire might spread on the very high winds that came in the last couple days. The Easy Fire is well west of us, but there's other fires out in Riverside and San Bernardino that are burning well east of us. There are no fewer than 13 bigger brush fires burning right this minute in our region, and a couple others that were burning just a week or two ago that have been contained.
Right. When you mentioned the Easy Fire out by the Ronald Reagan Library, we've heard from reporters who were standing there getting a briefing from firefighters when suddenly one said within, 60 seconds, the fire was on them, the smoke, they could barely breathe. Can you describe, I know you've covered fires in the state for a long time now. Can you describe that when that wind shifts?
Yeah, what people don't understand is how fast and far a fire can spread. People think they're going to stand in back of their house and watch the fire come at them like a wall. And yes, it can do that, but that fire is also going to cast on the wind embers that could land beyond you, and then suddenly you're trapped by fire.
Yeah.
And that's why we're so careful when we go out to fires to make sure that we are in an area that we can retreat from.
Yeah.
And that's why firefighters are so adamant that people leave when they're asked to.
Yeah, the smoke, the ash make it difficult for people to breathe. What are people being advised to do, and how is the shelter system going for evacuees?
You know, we have it down to it's such a routine in Southern California. Even though it's traumatic for somebody to be evacuated from their home, oftentimes people have friends and family to go to, so oftentimes shelters are not heavily populated overnight or evacuation centers during the day. It's a place to go in, check in with the Red Cross so that you can mark yourself safe. You can get some water there, some snacks. But generally, people, if they have any other place to go, will go to their friends' homes. So these shelters tend to be fairly lightly populated. An exception of that was the Getty Fire earlier this week. I think they had about 500 people staying in one shelter because the evacuation was in the very middle of the night, like 1:32 in the morning.
Yeah. And when do you think these winds will die down? The Santa Anas are seasonal, but what's the thinking?
The winds are predicted to continue through later today. The peak of the winds has probably passed already, so by the time it's time for kids to go out and do trick-or-treating, the winds should be quite a bit less.
Yeah, but still frightening in some neighborhoods. KPCC reporter Sharon McNary in Pasadena in California. Sharon, thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Here in London, where I am this week, everyone is talking about the election, which will happen on December 12th. Today, the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, says that if his party wins, he'll try to negotiate a new Brexit deal with the EU and then give people a choice to take his deal or cancel Brexit. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says if he wins, he'll take it as a mandate to take the UK out of the EU with his deal. We wanted to see how some of this country's young people are thinking about all of this. So we went to King's College and met up with three students.
Oh, hi, I'm Atiyab Rashid.
Hi, I'm Katerina Fletcher.
Hi, I'm Melissa Gerasinghe.
Atiyab Rashid is vice president of the college's Liberal Democrat Society. He's 20. Katerina Fletcher is president of the college's Politics Society. She's 23. And 21-year-old Melissa Gerasinghe is president of the College Conservative Association. None of them could vote in the referendum in 2016, so I asked them how they would have voted 3 years ago.
I'd have voted to remain.
I'd have voted to remain.
The same.
Now, tell me about your politics now.
Yeah, I'm with the Liberal Democrat Party.
I currently don't affiliate myself with any of the parties, but I'm leaning more towards Liberal Democrats as well.
I'm a member of the Conservative Party.
Conservative Party. But you say you would have voted to remain. Now, I know there are splits in the Conservative Party, but do you think that the Conservative Party represents you now?
I think it does, because I think it's still quite a broad church party. But today, if I was asked to vote, I'd vote Brexit, because if I was asked to vote in a confirmatory referendum, I'd vote Brexit.
Explain that to me. So you're for Remain, but you would actually vote to leave if there were another referendum. Why?
Well, because I feel like a confirmatory referendum wouldn't be... I don't think it's particularly democratic, and I think we as a country and as people of this country have a right to carry out what was voted for by the majority of people in this country in 2016.
Catherine, you disagree.
I definitely disagree, because yes, the majority of the people voted to leave, but it was by such a slim margin that almost half the population voted to stay. And a confirmatory referendum would then put a lot of the division and polarization to rest, especially if you did a two-tier referendum where you have like most of the where you have these different options in the first round of voting, to then have the two most popular results then be voted on again, just to truly make sure that all the different options and people's voices are heard.
Atiyab?
Yeah, well, I definitely support the idea of a confirmatory referendum. I don't really think saying that because we voted one way in 2016, it's illegitimate for people to vote another way in 2019 or 2020. I'm not really sure I see the logic behind that.
Well, that's not really the logic there. The logic is that regardless of whether it was a slim majority, it was still a majority, and that's how democracy works.
But it's not like a general election where the result holds for 5 years. This is meant to be seen as something permanent, and as something permanent, I think it needs to be done more delicately.
So let me ask each of you, because you're not actually in Parliament and you don't have to make these decisions, but you've been clearly thinking about them, what would you do now about Brexit?
I mean, my party, the Liberal Democrats, advocate if we get a majority in government, we'd revoke Article 50 or, in other circumstances, back a second referendum. And I do think that's the way forward.
And you think that the country would unite behind that decision if that happened?
I think the important thing to remember is we're in such a mess that in order to get out of this, it was caused by a referendum and we need another referendum. Obviously, we'd have to get a very large majority in order to win a majority in Parliament. So I do think there would be a democratic basis for revoking Article 50 under a Lib Dem majority government.
Melissa, how would you get out of this situation?
Well, I don't think they're really... Well, first of all, I don't think it's right to frame it as a mess because that, everyone knew that the process of exiting the EU, an incredibly complicated legislative body, would be a mess. I don't think anyone was expecting for it to be a simple thing, but I think the only way forward now is a general election.
And then what happens?
Well, I think the Conservative Party will win.
And then?
They'll try to put forward the softest Brexit possible if everything goes to plan.
Okay, and Catherine, what would you do to deal with the situation of Brexit at this point?
I mean, personally, I'd love to see Article 50 revoked, but I do think that because this situation has caused so much division, that if we were to just revoke it, then it would do way more harm than good. So I do think that there should be a second referendum.
Let me ask each of you, how you think that Brexit will impact you personally, if and when it happens?
I mean, personally, obviously, it very much limits my ability to work and travel in the EU. It adds barriers to that. Obviously, there'll be a negative economic impact, not just in London, but even some of the most pro-leave areas. And so I think it'll have a large effect on everyone. We won't be able to spend as much on our NHS, on our public services as we'd like to. And I think that's a massive shame.
Yeah, for me, it's definitely the ability to go work and live in other EU countries. I feel that most acutely. And it's also why I was so sad that I couldn't vote on it, because this referendum actually affects my passport. It's not just something that stays within the national borders. So the idea that I now can't go travel and live anywhere in Europe if I wanted to within the EU is just slightly heartbreaking. And it makes me... Now I belong to a country that I didn't have a say in and that has decided to become more of a closed nation rather than an open nation, and that's not something that I ideologically stand for.
Melissa, how would Brexit impact you personally, do you think?
I can't really tell how it will impact me personally, because undoubtedly there are going to be some short-term negative economic ramifications. But I think if you look at the whole problem more broadly, the reason people voted Brexit was because they saw the negative economic impact that untethered globalization and technological advancement had produced on the whole of the country. And some people in this country obviously felt left behind. And who talks about their benefits?
Atiyab, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, well, I feel obviously globalization has had negative impact on some areas of the UK, but I don't think the way to fix that is pretend that, you know, globalization shouldn't have happened, that we can get away from it. I think that's a silly view to take. I think what we should do is have proper policies which aren't just London centric, which help grow areas which have been slightly left behind. And, you know, it was the policies of Conservative governments under Thatcher which really, really led to the deprivation of many areas which now feel left behind. So I don't think it's exactly a great thing to say that, you know, pretend globalization never happened and then that will fix the problems in places like, you know, Grimsby or Hull.
I'm not anti-globalization. That's not what I said. But I think that it would be silly to pretend that, you know, most of the people that did vote Brexit are in these rural communities that don't feel like their views are being represented by the Remain hub in London.
Let's pretend like the Brexit referendum had never happened 3 years ago. What would you have hoped that your country was focused on over the last 3 years instead of spending every waking hour on Brexit?
Well, I think one of the things obviously is on everyone's mind is environmental policy. The Lib Dems want to, if we remain in the EU, work alongside the EU framework for making sure that we have a sustainable amount of climate change and working to mitigate the negative effects of that. But more than that, I'd want Britain within the EU to play a bigger role in the international stage, along with people like Emmanuel Macron in France, and championing this sort of muscular liberal order, making sure that places like Russia and China aren't getting out of hand and aren't undermining, you know, the democratic ideals which make up the Western world. I think that's very important.
Catherine?
I have to agree with environment as well. The UK is one of the world's leading powers when it comes to wind energy, for example. I think that more needs to be invested in that. The Conservatives stopped subsidising the construction of onshore wind power in 2016. That definitely needs to be revoked. I think, for example, like public transport needs to be improved. That also needs to be subsidised.
Are you optimistic about the future for the UK?
Not really. It makes me very sad to be part of a country that would vote for something like this, and also whose politicians then, instead of trying to be conciliatory, become more populist, and they also just then further embed the division within the country.
Atiyah?
Yeah, I'd say I am actually quite positive in my views of the future of this country. I think Brexit has really exposed some of the issues we have in this country and has now given us a time to fix them. A lot of things I disagree with, and I want to sort of change, like the first past the post system, implementing proportional representation, changing the House of Lords, and really changing Britain. I think we've been given this golden opportunity to do it, and that's why I am positive about Britain's future right now.
Melissa?
I think Atiyah is right. I don't feel like Brexit is necessarily as cataclysmic as it's framed to be. I think it was an inevitable event. It was inevitable that, you know, these tensions were going to come to the surface, and I'm sort of glad that we're in this in the midst of talking everything through and talking about where this country wants to be and the problems that are felt by ordinary working class people.
You know, it's interesting given the politics of now in the UK, which many people in this country are so disgusted with, that all of you are still interested in politics.
I mean, you can't just abandon the idea that, you know, of politics. I think politicians get a very bad rep, but at the end of the day, it's not politicians individually who create problems. It's the sort of aggregate. People have views and people disagree. And while it might not be, you know, this glorious revolutionary future where everything right will get implemented in the next parliament, it's a slow march of progress. And I very much back that vision. And I think that's what's important to take away from politics.
Yeah, for me, there's no alternative to being interested in politics, because if you're not interested in politics, that's akin to saying, I don't really care what happens to me. And that would be just a very miserable existence, to just go through life so passively as to not care when decisions are made that affect you so fundamentally.
Well, and I have to say, after listening to all of you, I'm optimistic about the future because you're all really smart and engaged. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
That is 23-year-old Katarina Fletcher, 20-year-old Atiyah Rashid, and 21-year-old Melissa Gersinga. They are students at King's College in London. And by the way, one voice you won't be hearing after today is that of John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Commons, who is stepping down after 10 years as Speaker. So we'll close this segment with words he has said so well so many times and said to us in our studio over the summer.
Order! Order! The House must come to order.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Before the Catholic Church rebranded it Hallows Eve, Halloween was an ancient Celtic holiday when the world of spirits became visible to the living. Hiding behind masks, villagers would play pranks on each other, offer treats to the gods. Somewhere along the way, candy companies got involved, and today, in 2019, costumes must meet a new high bar. How do they look on Instagram? One survey found that nearly half of millennials said they bought all their Halloween items exclusively for their social media posts. What? How does anyone put candy in your basket? Let's take a look at some of the business of this day with Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
So this does seem to be a millennial thing, because only a third of Gen Xers said they had bought Halloween items just for their social media. But give us a sense of some of the costumes we might see on our feeds tonight.
Well, believe it or not, Robin, millennials, they don't ruin everything. They love the social media. I've already seen, for example, a huge crab-type creature made from the millennials' favorite beverage, empty cans of White Claw. Claw, get it? there are pictures circulating of people dressed as his and her Popeye's chicken sandwiches. I think around Washington, D.C., wonk circles, you'll find the anonymous whistleblower costumes. It's not even necessarily about having a great time. There was an industry analyst that said about the millennials, it's about looking like you're having a great time.
Well, there you go. Quartz writes today about costume ideas for the new global economy. You could be Adam Neumann, the former WeWork CEO. They say wear a graphic tee, jeans, no shoes, and the biggest, shiniest golden parachute you can find. Invite everyone in, promising a consciousness-altering event right before it starts. Leave with all the snacks and book a venue on the upper floor so guests can admire the parachute as you float away. Ouch. You've looked at that list too. What did you see there?
I mean, look, back in my day, you wore something that people would get in 2 or 3 seconds max. The WeWork thing requires too much explanation, if you ask me. There was that one example that Court said, if you want to go as 5G, you know, next generation wireless, you tell all your friends that you'll be at the party at 7 p.m., then text them every hour that you're almost there and just need to take out some cash first. Then several hours later, you text after midnight and say you'll be there by 2023. I think an easier one. You wear the Bitcoin logo on your chest and just toggle between fits of euphoria and sobbing collapse on the floor.
Yeah.
You know?
Look, $86 per person is what we're expected to pay for Halloween. It's a near record high, more than $8 billion total, more than double the entire budget for the National Park Service. Just remind us how we got here.
Well, if you go back 100 years and look at the first costume efforts by some European immigrants in the Midwest, there was often horror, but really no wink-wink humor. And then you saw the corporatization of this kick in about 50 years ago with branded Disney apparel or comic book figures. That upped the bar for playfulness and cheekiness. And now that you have the smartphone and Instagram, you have whole new levels of showiness. You think about the guy who dressed like a giant CVS receipt. You know, that other character who mashed up Optimus Prime and Amazon Prime for a transformer made out of Amazon delivery boxes. I mean, it's really cutthroat.
Americans are expected to also spend about $500 million on Halloween costumes for their pets this year. That's double a decade ago. You have to wonder, where is it all going to go? I mean, how far do we go with this?
Look, this is... I think it's mostly fun escapism with some good-natured competition thrown in. It's also the unofficial opening night for holiday season consumerism, and that's like a $150 billion business.
Okay, let it begin. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
Happy Halloween.
Britain's auto industry is well known around the world, from Jaguars to Range Rovers to Bentleys to Rolls-Royces, even those famous London double-decker buses. And those automakers are very nervous about what changes to trade policy resulting from Brexit would mean for them. I sat down with Mike Hawes, chief executive of the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. That's the trade association for the auto industry here.
The industry in the UK comprises about 850,000 people. That includes those that make and those that sell. We're international. We export to over 160 different countries, contribute billions to international trade, are in fact the UK's biggest exporter by sector of goods. So we're fundamental to international trade for the UK.
Your group recently conducted a study that found 1 in 3 British automotive firms is cutting jobs as Brexit nears. That's a huge impact.
It's massive. That is the threat that a no-deal Brexit poses for the industry. And you're seeing companies making decisions of fear of no-deal Brexit. Companies are looking to relocate. Some of them have already admitted that they've lost orders. Some have, and as a result of that, have reduced employment. This is a difficult, difficult time for the industry.
What about, no deal aside, how does your group and the industry feel about Brexit in general?
Well, we're not a campaigning organization, but we made very clear both before, during, and after the referendum that we viewed the relationship that we had as a sector with Europe to be as good as you could get. Part of the single market, part of the customs union, totally integrated into the European automotive industry. So any change to that arrangement is likely to be a reduction in the competitive terms under which we operate. So since then, it's been a case of damage limitation. What is it that we can do to try and ensure and safeguard this industry? We don't just trade with Europe, but Europe accounts for over half of our finished vehicle exports.
I can imagine that somebody who is really in favor of leave would say to you, well, aren't you excited about the prospect that Britain will be able to do trade deals with anybody that they want to, and maybe you'll even do more trade of automobiles than you do now?
I don't view that we were held back from doing so by being members of the European Union. As it is, we trade to over 160 different countries. Through the UK's membership of the EU, we have preferential trading agreements with over 40 additional countries, big automotive countries like South Korea, Canada. Japan has been agreed. They're doing deals with Mercosur. So the question is, where else? The two obvious answers are the US and China, the two biggest international automotive markets. But as we know, in trade terms, it's, you know, in terms of negotiation, size does matter. And being able to negotiate a deal with respectively those two countries will not be easy.
Why?
As it is, we're already seeing rising global trade tensions. We potentially had Brexit this Thursday. That's now been postponed. Within two and a half weeks of that, the US administration will decide on the potential application of Section 232 tariffs on the import of global automotive products. That would hit us badly too.
What has been a bigger problem for you so far, Brexit or the trade war going on in the United States?
I think at the moment, the one that's really affected us is Brexit, because that has undermined confidence, investors' confidence in the UK because of this fear of no deal. And it's, you know, that fear of if investors were calm and confident that they could continue to survive and grow and prosper under no deal, then investment would have continued. It has virtually stalled over the last 12 months. A couple of exceptions where British companies have invested in Britain, but international investment has effectively stalled. But the impact of perhaps some of the US actions hasn't yet been seen because we wait to see what the decision is on Section 232.
What's at stake when it comes to jobs in the United Kingdom? There's already been talk about the company Nissan abandoning plans to build a new model at that factory in Sunderland in the UK.
We have seen some very disappointing announcements, including Nissan saying that the particular model was going to be built in Japan rather than Sunderland. Honda announcing it was closing its factory. It's easy to blame everything on Brexit and Brexit uncertainty, but that would be wrong. Globally, the industry is facing a very challenging set of circumstances. You're changing the way we make cars with digitalization and manufacturing, changing the way you power them as you move towards electrified vehicles, connected vehicles, self-driving vehicles coming, as well as the global environmental and trade geopolitical issues. That maelstrom is happening internationally. So decisions that have been taken here are in the context of that global issue, as well as the local conditions. The threat for Brexit is that it undermines the long-term competitiveness of the UK automotive industry. I don't expect to wake up in 3 months' time and the factories close overnight. But if you gradually undermine the competitiveness, it's like death by a thousand cuts. You don't necessarily, are not necessarily in pole position to get the next model allocated.
You're not focusing on the longer term things that you need to focus on because you're having to spend so much time worried about Brexit.
There is that, but also it's more about the fundamentals. If you had a no deal Brexit and the imposition of tariffs, in our case to Europe, that would be 10%. 10% is way in excess of the margin that most individual plants operate on. They're looking at sort of 2% to 4% return on investment. A 10% tariff would totally undermine the proposition. The head of Nissan a couple of weeks ago said no deal Brexit does not fit the Nissan business model in Europe.
Let me ask you about one thing that's not related to Brexit, which is right now, and you talked about environmental regulations and standards. The Trump administration is saying that California's standards, which are higher than the national standards in the U.S., shouldn't be allowed anymore, and that the automakers should have a lower standard for auto emissions.
Does that affect you at all? Or what do you think about that as you watch that from the UK?
It is interesting for a start. I mean, you know, we talk about some of the challenges that are here, and we also see them on the other side of the Atlantic. The global industry is on a shift ultimately to get towards zero emission mobility. How you get there, how quickly you get there, will vary from market to market, because you've got to always take the consumer with us. In the UK, we tend to drive, compared to the States, smaller vehicles. Yes, SUVs, but smaller vehicles than some ones you drive. And we generally speaking don't drive pickup trucks. Mm-hmm.
Get better gas mileage.
We get a better gas mileage because fuel is more expensive in this country. The industry the industry globally is on that journey. The more consistency there is, I mean, what you don't want to do is position where you've got to make certain models for one market compared to another, compared to a third, because that undermines efficiency and obviously raises prices. So we look at across the Atlantic, and it is odd to see a government, you know, arguing that the environmental standards should technically be weakened, whereas here in Europe, we're facing ever tougher standards, and we see that in so many other global markets. But at the end of the day, you will always make vehicles that meet the required standards in whatever market you're operating in. So whatever happens over a long period, we will have to comply.
Let me ask you one final question. If we weren't talking all about Brexit right now, what would be the story you would want to tell about the UK auto industry right now?
I still believe the strengths of the UK automotive industry are world-class. High levels of engineering excellence, some globally famous brand names, Rolls-Royce, Bentley, Aston, McLaren, to name but a few.
Jaguar,
Land Rover. We're almost uniquely, I think, probably uniquely globally, we have this long array of small, high-value sports luxury manufacturers, which are often the envy of the world. Most other countries would kill to have that sort of brand heritage and thing. We need to make sure we remain competitive. But what I'd rather be talking about, what the industry would rather be investing in, are these new technologies: electrified vehicles, connected vehicles, autonomous vehicles. That's what the rest of the world is focused on. That's what we in the UK should be focused on as well.
What do you make of the fact that the Prime Minister goes into Jaguar and the royal family takes Rolls Royces wherever they go?
I think the royal family, they have Bentley, they have Rolls.
They have Range Rovers too, right?
And Range Rovers. They're great supporters of UK automotive manufacturing. God bless them.
That is Mike Hawes, who is Chief Executive of the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders here in the UK. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
By the way, President Trump weighed in today while we're on the air on the coming election in the UK, saying on a London radio station that opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn would be, quote, so bad for the UK.
Happy Halloween. If this day has a signature sound, this might be it. Theremin is the soundtrack of Spooky. Think 1951's The Day the Earth Stood Still, or those tapes you play on your porch to scare kids. But Leon Theremin's invention has been inspiring classical musicians and composers since it first wowed the world in 1920. Andrea Shea from member station WBUR spoke with some contemporary artists who premiered a new work celebrating this early electronic instrument's upcoming 100th birthday.
The Boston Modern Orchestra Project's percussion, string, and wind musicians grasp their instruments as they rehearse Sirens, a new concerto for theremin. Up front, sitting on a chair, 31-year-old soloist Carolina Eich looks like she's playing the air between two antennas poking out of a metal and wood base that sits on a stand.
Well, if you don't know the theremin, then, you know, you might think, oh, there's somebody waving the hands in the air and doing magic. But I can actually change the pitch with my right hand and the volume with my left hand.
Ike's hands dance like a conductor's inside an invisible electromagnetic field. They evoke the articulated precision of sign language. Ike started playing the theremin when she was 7. As a teen, she studied with Lydia Kavina, whose grandfather was Leon Theremin's cousin. Ike even created her own series of hand positions.
So I can play a scale, for example, by starting with a closed hand and then slowly opening my hand until all the fingers are stretched out.
There's no instrument like it. It's an instrument of paradoxes.
Composer and thereminist Dalit Warshaw had Ike in mind for her new concerto. Warshaw says electronic instruments don't breathe, so the theremin's fluid vocal lines can go on and on. Its vast range swoops to hit searingly high pitches and shifts seamlessly to dark low ones.
The seductive aspect of writing for the theremin, for me, is the capacity to instill a human sound onto something completely mechanical. And that there's, when a performer addresses this instrument, there's always the tension between these two components.
Leon Theremin invented his pioneering instrument in 1920 while working for the fledgling Soviet government as a physicist. Its otherworldly sounds captivated audiences when he took it on tour. Boston Modern Orchestra Project artistic director Gil Rose says whenever the orchestra explores the development of 20th century technology and classical music, they always go back to the theremin.
After World War I, there was a freedom to express things, and there was a new electronic age. So it was an attempt by composers and inventors to collaborate to increase the palette and the tools for composers to use while writing orchestra music.
The 100th birthday concert also includes one of the earliest pieces written for theremin, Joseph Schillinger's First Airphonic Suite from 1929. Rose says seeing a theremin virtuoso play live is way better than hearing the instrument in a movie score.
It's fascinating. In fact, I've always warned the orchestra, quit watching the thereminist. Play your part. Yeah, don't get distracted. It's because it's easy to get distracted because this is kind of a mystical thing. It's both science and mysticism brought into the same realm.
Pushing the instrument into uncharted territory and sharing its versatility drive Carolina Ike. She just released a new recording where she blends the theremin's voice with her own.
I just wish that people are open-minded and take the sound in as they listen to it and don't compare it to anything.
Even at 100 years old, Ike says the theremin is still a relatively young instrument, and its weird, beautiful voice still has a long way to go. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Jeremy, in London, I picture little Boris Johnsons with big hair.
I think there are. And by the way,
yeah,
in Scotland, they carve turnips instead of pumpkins.
What? There you go.
Yeah.
What are you doing tonight?
Scare
me.
Probably.
Scare me,
I don't
Hobson.
Have any candy to give out.
Yeah. Here in Austin, production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.